So by kind of creating these different administrative rules and kind of dragging things out, it really makes FOIA a less efficient and less helpful tool when it comes to actually getting records.
And I want to thank you for being with us. Open Records Manager at the Center for Constitutional Rights. His most recent piece for The New Republic we'll link to at democracynow.org, my front row seat to the slow death of the Freedom of Information Act. That does it for our show. Our condolences to our audio engineer, to Miguel Noguera, and his sister Anna, and the whole family on the death of their mom. What a wonderful woman. That does it for the show. We'll be in Kansas City for the screening of Steal the Story, Please, July 17th and 18th, and Martha's Vineyard on July 31st. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a weekly newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota. Produced by Ambers, Minnesota's community radio stations, with support from the state of Minnesota.
I'm Victor Palomino.
And I'm Britt Ahmet. Minnesota's cultural diversity is a blend of experiences from around the world. This week, we're dedicating the program to these cultures by exploring some of the corridors that reflect the Twin Cities' rich multiculturalism.
Then, we head to central Minnesota to look at a landmark that has held Ojibwe history for decades.
But first, North Star Stories reporter Zan Holston with some of the stories that made headlines this week.
The Fond du Lac Band is expanding healthcare services in Duluth. The more than 33,000 square foot space will give the center more room for clinic care and public health work for Native patients in Duluth and the region. The expansion is expected to open in 2028. Construction is also moving ahead on a new housing development in Thief River Falls. A city housing study found rental availability is less than 1%, and the area has jobs to offer but few housing options for workers. Thief River Falls says the 65-unit apartment development uses public and private money and is expected to open next summer. A free speech fight over science and politics is now headed to federal court. Two former biologists at the Environmental Protection Agency's Great Lakes Research Lab in Duluth are among seven ex-EPA scientists suing the agency. They say they were fired for signing a public dissent letter last year, criticizing politicization, research cuts, and a culture of fear at the agency. Money from one of Minnesota's biggest pollution settlements is now going into parks, streams, fishing areas, and habitat in the East Metro. The state is now able to spend an additional $20 million from its 2018 settlement with 3M for its PFAS contamination. PFAS are so-called forever chemicals because they never break down and contaminate water, soil, and fish. Minnesota sued Maplewood-based 3M in 2010, saying the company's disposal of those chemicals damaged drinking water and natural resources in the East Metro. 3M agreed to pay $850 million in 2018 without admitting liability. For farmers along Minnesota's Iowa border, some of the steadiest income now comes from the wind. The Freeborn Wind Project is a wind farm spread across farm fields in Freeborn County, near Albert Lea, with part of the project just across the state line in northern Iowa. Federal energy data shows wind now generates about a quarter of Minnesota's electricity. For farmers, the project means income. XL Energy is paying tens of millions of dollars to farmers and landowners to build the wind turbines over the life of the Freeborn Project. Farmer Bill Gillen says some neighbors were worried when the turbines were first proposed, but nearly all the land can still be used for farming.
When we built this project here, there's a lot of people thought the world was going to come to an end. It was not the monster that a lot of people like to make it out to be.
Gillen says the turbines give farmers a steady paycheck that doesn't depend on rain or crop prices. Thanks to our news gathering partners at Public News Service. In Rochester, nearly 100 workers are wondering about their jobs as city leaders make changes to its public transportation system. City leaders made official changes to who runs the day-to-day operations of Rochester Public Transit as the city builds a long-term growth plan to include rapid bus transit. The current operator notified the state that 84 Rochester workers could be affected when its local operations end in late August. When Rochester started the planning process last fall, Transit and Parking Director Rachel Fouch said the focus was to put people first as the city expands its public transportation options.
Transit is more than numbers on a piece of paper. These are individuals that rely on our transit services to get to work, to get to their doctor's appointments, to see their parents, to see their friends. And so it's really important that we have a very people-first approach.
The city says the transition is designed to keep service running for riders and protect employees through the handoff. The company says it expects the incoming operator to keep most of the workers to continue current services, but there's no certainty. A tornado tore through parts of west central Minnesota, injuring at least three people in Becker County. The storm hit the Floyd Lake area north of Detroit Lakes, downing trees, flipping boats, and damaging homes. Becker County Sheriff Todd Glander says once the storms passed, community members were able to take in the full scope.
Roofs off of houses and buildings tipped over. Honestly, people just standing there in awe, not knowing really what had just happened. Yeah, it's very emotional.
Sheriff Glander says it could take days or weeks to clean up and asks people to stay away from the Floyd Lake area while officials assess storm damage. An emergency shelter is open at M State in Detroit Lakes. Minnesota charter school leaders and Governor Walz are standing up for kindergartners, saying children should be off limits from political attacks. President Trump shared a social media video of a kindergarten graduation at a St. Paul charter school last month. The clip shows children in caps and gowns, including many girls wearing hijabs, and identifies the school and location. He shared it a second time, reposting derogatory comments about the hijabs. Governor Walz criticized Trump for attacking kindergartners' school clothes, while charter school leaders said sharing the image and naming the school puts children at greater risk. The president's social media attacks come as faith leaders in Minnesota and across the country are calling on state leaders to protect voting access and push back against election interference. Interfaith clergy held events at the state capitol in St. Paul, the Olmsted County Elections Office in Rochester, and across the U.S. At the Minnesota State Capitol, Imam Makram El Amin said faith communities need to speak up now, framing voting rights as a moral responsibility.
Justice is not passive. It requires action. Yeah. It requires witness. It requires participation.
The events were part of a National Day of Action organized by Faith in Us, a clergy network formed in Minnesota. And finally, July is prime time for baby loons to start swimming around. While cute, they're often difficult to see from a boat while out on the water, and the chicks are too little to dive down or fly away in order to escape boats. The best way to help is to slow down and look out. The DNR says give loon families plenty of room because boat traffic can force loons off nests and put chicks in danger. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
People from around the globe have called Minnesota home, making the state a hub of cultural diversity.
Today, we can trace those roots to sacred spaces and cultural corridors across cities and towns alike.
Reporter Faya Adam takes us to a program from the Humanities Center, helping Minnesotans experience those places firsthand.
Minnesota is home to dozens of cultural corridors, neighborhoods, and sacred spaces that tell the story of the people who built them. Now, an initiative from the Minnesota Humanities Center hopes to bring those stories directly to residents through guided tours across the state. The annual series, called Learning from Place, Twin Cities Cultural Corridors and Sacred Spaces, invites participants to experience communities firsthand through history, food, and storytelling.
The Bedote experience was really, really powerful and impactful. The whole time as we were going through this experience in the Twin Cities, I just kept thinking, like, this isn't new. Racism and injustice are not, you know, solely a 2026 issue. It didn't start in January.
Leah Ingram is the Program Director for Social Impact and Communications at the Center for the Common Good at the University of St. Thomas. Earlier this year, she participated in a Learning from Place experience with students that included visits to the Buddhist temple Wat Munisatorum in Farmington and Bedote at the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers in the metro.
It was a cold morning. It was the end of March. And like really being in the physical space and thinking about like, what are we doing as a community and what have we been doing, I think was really powerful.
She says the experience at Bedote, a sacred cultural site for Dakota people, was emotional in a way that reading a textbook or attending a lecture could never replicate.
to like really be in a place where things happened or continue to happen, to see that, like, you know, there's real people behind the stories, and there's not just necessarily the people who have experienced things themselves, but people whose ancestors have endured things.
Ingram says the tour has left her feeling both challenged and hopeful.
There's so much value and so much beauty in the resilience that makes up our community.
For Michael Fredericks, Director of Cultural Initiatives and Immersive Programs at the Minnesota Humanities Center, place creates an opportunity for multiple stories to exist at once.
We actually went to a place where my family had gone to for many years, one of our favorite places to picnic and to hike.
Frederick says she experienced that firsthand during a Learning from Place visit to Bedote with her daughter.
And I actually had the opportunity to do that with my 10-year-old daughter, and it was transformative for her. She ended up falling in love with history, and she saw a connection with her Hmong heritage to our indigenous community.
Frederick says the goal is not just to teach people about a community, but to immerse them in it.
You can learn about community through different nonprofits, their mission, their programs. But as a metaphor, I see that as learning about community as a houseplant is somewhat contained. And so to bring people into the community, into these cultural corridors, you get to see and learn community in its organic environment and see how they flourish.
It's important for people to understand their history.
Kevin Lindsay is the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center.
To understand and better navigate through their present reality and also to plan their future. So unless we understand our history, we're at a disadvantage in our present day situation and looking forward into the future.
The tours include visits to Little Mekong and St. Paul, Bedote, and Somali cultural corridors.
There are some folks that really do appreciate getting their hands into the work, being able to experience the learning in a very physical way. That also helps people understand and appreciate and learn more about a different culture than they might otherwise just simply read within a book.
Another featured cultural corridor is Little Africa Plaza in St. Paul. Dr. Jingle Galu is the founder and CEO of African Economic Development Solutions in the Little Africa Cultural and Business District.
You know, cultural corridor is essential because a place is ultimately it's about people. They remind us who lived in that area and what they built, how their stories shaped our fabric. Minnesota history.
Galgalu says cultural districts represent more than just business or development.
Learning from place, and instead of seeing places and communities as a deficit, seeing them as assets, it's crucial, it's empowering.
That sense of belonging became especially important this year as immigrant communities face uncertainty and fear in the face of federal immigration enforcement actions. Michael Frederick says those concerns shape conversations about how the tours would move forward.
Metro Surge had a tremendous impact on our cultural corridors and our communities of color. As we were looking to figure out how do we move forward together, we knew that we needed to do more than just support these small businesses through commerce. The beauty of Learning from Place is that it is a platform to slow down, to hear their story.
Rather than scaling back, Frederick says the Humanities Center expanded the program.
I think when we are able to slow down to see each other and hear each other's story, the healing starts.
For organizers, that's ultimately what Learning from Place is about. Creating opportunities for people to meet their neighbors, challenge assumptions, and better understand the communities that make up Minnesota. For North Star Stories, I'm Faya Adam.
After the break, how the Western African and Mexican American communities have shaped parts of the Twin Cities.
And look at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post.
This is North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, produced by Ampers with the support from the state of Minnesota.
We'll be right back.
Ampers is diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. We are an association of 17 independent community radio stations in Minnesota with over 300,000 listeners. We support our stations through revenue, training, and original news, arts, and cultural programs. Ampers programming is produced for and by the communities in our station's regions and aims to correct narratives about historically underrepresented groups. Check out what we're up to online at ampers.org, on Instagram, and Facebook.
You are listening to North Star Stories. I'm Britt Ahmet.
And I'm Victor Palomino.
The next event in the Learning from Place series from the Minnesota Humanities Center will be on July 16th in South Minneapolis, in a vibrant corridor of Somali and West African-owned businesses, cultural institutions, and public art.
To learn more about this event and the community, we are joined now by Jursa Muhammad, curator of this experience with the Humanities Center. Jursa is a business consultant, storyteller, and longtime connector within the South Minneapolis East African community. She also hosts the podcast Eat and Talk MN. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to know more about the learning from places. What can you tell us about the East African community in Minneapolis?
So the East African community has been in Minneapolis for over 30 years. My family arrived in the early 90s. And when we arrived, there was already like a couple thousand of Somali people living there at the time. Our communities kind of followed each other, especially after the Civil War. Lutheran churches played an important role in helping Somalis and East Africans that were displaced find a place and find jobs and find support here in Minneapolis. And so East Africans and Somalis came from an entrepreneurial background, so it wasn't hard for them to start their own small businesses here. And so that's how we kind of built an entire cultural corridor from Lake Street to Cedar Riverside.
I had a conversation with the director of the Somali Museum. He was talking about how that's one of the places that have a collection of the history of Somalia that is unique, not only in the state, but also probably in the world.
Having the Somali Museum be our first stop on July 16th is really important and special because that place does hold a lot of historical artifacts that not just shows, but really visualize the cultural aspect of what the Somali community is and where we came from. We also have cultural dance, and we also showcase like what homes look like back in Somalia, what kind of storytelling we do. So we're very big on music and poetry. And the Somali Museum is a great place that brings all of those together to showcase like what Somali and who Somali people really are.
And people that want to attend on July 16, tell us a little bit how the day is going to be.
So we're going to start at the Mitangolo Market, and we are going to start with the Somali Museum, a stop there where we'll get a full guided tour. And then we will make our way to the Hoyo Sambusa, which is an amazing new sambusa factory. Sambusa is a staple appetizer, staple food in the Somali community. And so it was really important for us to start with, you know, what and why and where sambusa comes from and how it's made.
For listeners that are not familiar with sambusa, how do you describe it?
Sambusas are a type of egg roll. It's a triangular appetizer that has different fillings, typically ground beef, lots of amazing seasonings like cumin. And then we also have like fish versions, veggie versions, and so on and so forth. So we can also compare it if you're familiar with the empanada, like it's our version of that as well.
I think we can solve a lot of problems in the world through food, and especially just finding like the version of sambusa and empanada in every culture and then just make like a United Nations of food.
Yes, I agree. Like a dumplings tour.
What else is going to happen that day?
After we do the Midtown Global Market, we are then going to walk, and we're going to have a guided mural tour by a local Somali artist named Golson, who has a number of murals across South Minneapolis that we get to walk to, and he's going to tell us about the meaning and the stories behind his art. We are then going to visit a 10-plus year small business called Zizi Boutique, and that's a modest retail store by a Somali woman named Bilkis. It's a staple in Minneapolis, but it also showcases the clothing wear of Somali traditional women, as well as modest and modern clothing. And then from there, we go ahead and we walk to the largest Somali mall in America, which is Carmel Mall. It is just a plethora of businesses, from jewelry shops to food to clothes. And it has a praying centers. Attendees will have the option to explore on their own the Somali Mall and try out some amazing food and drinks and hopefully get a cup of Somali tea.
The Somali community has been in the news in the last couple of years, sometimes not for the portraying the best part of the community. What do you wish the community at large know about the Somali community, and what do you wish that they will take after taking a tour like this?
Yeah, I really hope that people understand the sense of belonging that Somalis have in Minneapolis and in Minnesota after this tour. And I really hope that they're able to understand that this is why we call it home, and that this does feel like home, and it's not a place that we are just getting accustomed or assimilated to. So I really hope that they do feel like we are truly their neighbors, and that we are truly one in community with them, and that we care about building this city with them, because we have our families and we have our children here, and we are not planning to go anywhere.
Jirsa, thank you so much for taking the time talking to us.
Thank you so much as well. I appreciate it.
St. Paul's West Side is considered by many as the heart of Minnesota's Latino community. And on July 24th, the Learning from Place event will focus on the Flats and the Latino Cultural District, a neighborhood shaped by generations of Mexican Americans and now home to the future Minnesota Latino Museum.
We are joined now by Larry Lucio Sr., a longtime resident of St. Paul West Side. Larry is the guy for the visit. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about the Learning in Place experience that's going to happen on July 24th at St. Paul West Side.
Well, the Minnesota Humanities Council approached myself and my son, Larry Lucio Jr., and requested the opportunity to do a visit on the West Side to talk about the historical perspective of the West Side Flats specifically. Quite frankly, that story has been told many times, but is often the case, very few, if any, were residents of the flat. I was born and raised literally on the lower flats of the West Side, a family of 12. So the history of the flats is still fairly strong in my mind.
How is the visit going to be?
Well, what we want to do is talk about the, as I said, the flats, but also in the West Side flats in relation to what another part of that community refers to themselves as, the Lower West Side, and then the connectedness to the Lilydale community. Those three communities, it's all within a 2-mile radius. We're going to talk about that. We're going to do a bus tour and try to give people the opportunity to imagine where the various aspects of what the West Side involvement was, the neighborhood house, Our Lady Guadalupe Church. As silly as it sounds, the city dump was right down there. There were just a lot of different aspects that, as a resident of the flats, we lived around, so to speak.
Can you describe for our listeners that part of town?
Okay, well, the flats was, for many, many, many years, and I would hazard a guess it still is, or is one of the most diverse communities in the Twin City area. But for the longest time, it was a very diverse community, predominantly Mexican-American. It started as a Jewish community many years ago. As the communities of color moved into the community, the Jewish community began to move out. So the Mexican community, and from my perspective, has always been the backbone of the West Side Flats and now the West Side community. But it was a very diverse community, African-American, Native American. There were some Lebanese, Syrian, a few Jewish families remained, but it was mainly Mexican.
And you said that now there is an industrial park there.
Right. Again, government, they informed our families that we had to leave the flats area because of the flooding. Now, we would get flooded out every couple of years, and that was their excuse to require us to leave our community. We were one of the last families to move out in 1961. Mm-hmm. And by the summer of 62, they had razed all of the West Side homes and began to build business. And of course, they found money eventually to build a flood wall to help protect the businesses. But we were forced to leave our homes and move up what we referred to when we were living on the flats, to move up the hill, which predominantly right now is the Cesar Chavez community, right around the community that Cesar Chavez runs through, and Robert Street.
Larry, is there anything else you want to add to the conversation?
Yeah, first and foremost, we welcome anybody who would be interested in learning more about the history of the West Side community to go to the Minnesota Humanities Council and register. The stores, the restaurants, and just the overall vibe of our community, I would encourage anybody and everybody to come and visit and experience.
Just want to thank you again for coming here and talking to us today.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity, Victor.
You can find information and registration for all the Learning in Place series at the Minnesota Humanities Center website at mnhum.org.
Minnesota's cultural richness is not only found in the Twin Cities metro area. The state is home to cultural sites and museums that tell the stories of the many communities living here.
In Onamia in central Minnesota, the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post exhibits the history of the Ojibwe people alongside a restored 1930s trading post. Last month, the museum celebrated its 30th anniversary at that location. To learn more, we're joined now by Lily Lauer, Program Supervisor at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post. She's also a descendant of Lacoudere in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the museum exhibits and collections.
Yeah, so we are the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post. We are on the land of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and we tell their story specifically here at our museum, as well as portions about veterans in our community and treaties and sovereignty, as well as our Four Seasons Room, which is a guided tour at our museum. And our other part of our site, we also have our trading post, which is a 1930s replica of what was standing here on site. It has been in a trading post for 101 years this year, and it is still an active trading post today.
You have this big anniversary this year. How are you celebrating the 30th anniversary?
So we are doing lots of things this year to kind of celebrate all year. We did have a little intimate dinner and collections tours on the actual birthday. So that was May 18th. And then we had a large event on June 13th. That was the first day for our walking tours that we are piloting this year. For the rest of the year, we do have different things going on. We have Kids Craft Saturdays. We are doing those walking tours. And then we will have Artist of the Month. And then we're also doing Native Art and Artist programs. It's more of a lecture series, so people can get tickets for that. And that's one day out of the month.
You lease the land from the band. How is the band involved otherwise in the administration of the site?
We have events here that the band and our site kind of collaborate on. So we have our Memorial Day powwow. We have the Native Art Festival. We have the chief come over and do talks and things like that. And we have artists that come over and rent the space sometimes if they want. It's also free of charge for Mille Lacs band members and any other tribal member. Whether you're enrolled anywhere in the country, you're free here.
Where can our listeners find out more about your museum?
Yeah, we are pretty active on social media, I would say, for our site. So whether you are a Facebook or Instagram user, we are active on that, which you can find by searching Mille Lacs Indian Museum or Trading Post. You can also go to the Minnesota Historical Society website and find our site.
Well, that's it. Thank you so much, Lily Lauer, for spending time with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
This is it for today's program. If you miss any part of today's newscast, you can find this and past episodes at ampers.org or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You can also get North Star Stories daily on our website or check your favorite station's schedule.
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, Minnesota's community radio stations, with support from the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center presenting Summer at the Cedar 2026, a series of free weekly outdoor concerts on the Cedar Plaza every Wednesday evening from July 8th through August 5th. Wednesday, July 29th, Summer at the Cedar presents Tiga. Tiga is an electronic duo blending traditional Mongolian sounds with modern techniques to create a new kind of nomadic psychedelic music. More information about Summer at the Cedar is available at thecedar.org.